Beeves and Hogs to the packing plant in Harrisonburg adds $1 to every pound of beef or pork Polyface sells, and $2 to every pound of ham or bacon, which regulations prohibit Joel from smoking himself. Curing meat is considered manufacturing, he explained, smoking slightly now himself, and manufacturing is prohibited in an area zone for agriculture. Joel is convinced clean food could compete with supermarket food if the government would exempt farmers from the thicket of regulations that prohibit them from processing and selling meat from the farm. For him, regulation is the single biggest impediment to building a viable local food chain, and what's at stake is our liberty, nothing less. We do not allow the government to dictate what religion you can observe, so why should we allow them to dictate what kind of food you can buy? He believes freedom of food, the freedom to buy a pork chop from the farmer who raised the hog, should be a constitutional right. While Teresa chatted with customers as she checked them out, occasionally dispatching Daniel or Rachel to fetch a dozen eggs from the fridge or a roast from the walk-in freezer, Galen and I helped Joel compost chicken waste. This just may be the grossest job on the farm, or anywhere else for that matter. Yet I came to see that even the way Polyface handles its chicken guts is, as Joel would say, an extension of his worldview. Joel went off on the tractor to get a load of wood chips from the big pile he keeps across the road, while Galen and I hauled 5-gallon buckets of blood and guts and feathers from the processing shed to the compost pile, which is only a stone's throw from the house. The day was getting steamy, and the heaping mound of wood chips, beneath which simmered earlier installments of chicken waste, exhaled a truly evil stink. I've encountered some funky compost piles, but this one smelled like, well, exactly what it was. Rotting flesh. I realized that this was what I had caught the occasional waft of during my first sleepless night in the trailer. Beside the old pile, Joel dumped a few yards of fresh wood chips, which Galen and I raked into a broad rectangular mound about the size of a double bed, leaving a slight depression in the middle. Into this dip we spilled the buckets of guts, forming a glistening, parti-colored stew. On top of this we added the pillowy piles of feathers, and finally the blood, which now had the consistency of house paint. By now Joel was back with another load of chips, which he proceeded to dump onto the top of the pile. Galen climbed up onto the mass of wood chips with his rake, and I followed him with mine. The top layer of wood chips was dry, but you could feel the viscera sliding around underfoot. It felt like walking on a mattress filled with jello. We raked the pile level and got out of there. The compost pile repulsed me, but what did that say? Beyond the stench in my nostrils, which, believe me, was not so easy to get beyond, the pile offered an inescapable reminder of all that eating chicken involves. The killing, the bleeding, the evisceration. And no matter how well it is masked or how far it is hidden away, this death smell, and the reality that gives rise to it, shadows the eating of any meat, industrial, organic, or whatever, is part and parcel of even this grassy, pastoral food chain whose beauty had so impressed me. I wondered whether my disgust didn't cover a certain shame I was feeling about the morning's work. Just at the moment, I wasn't sure I could imagine eating chicken again anytime soon. I certainly couldn't imagine keeping this rotting heap of chicken guts an errant summer's breeze away from my dinner table. But Joel probably saw that pile in a very different light than I did. Who knows, by now it might not even smell all that bad to him. For Joel, yet another of the advantages of processing chickens here is that it allows him to keep the whole cycle of birth, growth, death, and decay on the land. Otherwise, the waste would end up in a rendering plant, there to be superheated, dried, and pelleted, turned into protein meal, and fed to factory-farmed pigs and cattle and even other chickens, a dubious practice that mad cow disease has rendered even more dubious. This is not a system he wants any part of. It could be that Joel even finds a certain beauty in that compost pile, or at least in its redemptive promise. He certainly hasn't hidden it away. Like every other bit of waste on this farm, he regards chicken guts as a form of biological wealth. Nitrogen he can return to the land by locking it down with carbon he's harvested from the woodlot. Having seen what happened to last year's pile, and all the piles before that, Joel can see the future of this one in a way I can't. Its promise to transubstantiate this mass of blood and guts and feathers into a particularly rich, cakey black compost, improbably sweet-smelling stuff that, by spring, will be ready for him to spread onto the pastures and turn back into grass. Chapter 13. The Market. Greetings from the non-barcode people. Wednesday afternoon. Following the corn-based industrial food chain had taken me on a journey of several thousand miles, from George Naylor's Iowa fields to the feedlots and packing plants of Kansas, through any number of far-flung food processors before ending up in a Marin County McDonald's. After that, it didn't surprise me to read that the typical item of food on an American's plate travels some 1,500 miles to get there, and is frequently better traveled and more worldly than its eater. By comparison, the grass-based food chain rooted in these Virginia pastures is, for all its complexity, remarkably short. I had been able to follow it for most of its length without leaving the Salatin's property. The farm work in Virginia may have been more taxing than in Iowa, killing chickens as compared to planting corn, but the detective work here was a relative cinch. And all that remained to do now was to trace the grass-based food chain along the various marketing paths linking Joel's pastures to his customers' plates. What had brought me to Polyface in the first place, you'll recall, was Joel's refusal to FedEx me a steak. I was given to understand that his concept of sustainability was not limited to agricultural technique or processing method, but extended the entire length of the food chain. Joel is no more likely to sell his grass-finished beef to Whole Foods, let alone Walmart, than he would be to feed his cows grain, chicken manure, or Rumensin. As far as he's concerned, it is all of the same industrial piece. So Polyface does not ship long distance, does not sell into supermarkets, and does not wholesale its food. All 300 chickens we'd processed Wednesday morning would be eaten within a few dozen miles, or at the most, half a day's drive of the farm. Originally, I assumed Joel's motive for keeping his food chain so short was strictly environmental. To save on the prodigious quantities of fossil fuel Americans burn moving their food around the country and, increasingly today, the world. But it turns out Joel aims to save a whole lot more than energy. A chicken, or steak, or ham, or carton of eggs can find its way from Polyface Farm to an eater's plate by five possible routes. Direct sales at the farm store, farmer's market, metropolitan buying clubs, a handful of small shops in Staunton, and Joel's brother Art's panel truck, which makes deliveries to area restaurants every Thursday. Each of these outlets seems quite modest in itself, yet taken together they comprise the arteries of a burgeoning local food economy that Joel believes is indispensable to the survival of his kind of agriculture and community, not to mention to the reform of the entire global food system. In Joel's view, that reformation begins with people going to the trouble and expense of buying directly from farmers they know. Relationship marketing, as he calls it. He believes the only meaningful guarantee of integrity is when buyers and sellers can look one another in the eye, something few of us ever take the trouble to do. Don't you find it odd that people will put more work into choosing their mechanic or house contractor than they will into choosing the person who grows their food? Joel often speaks of his farming as his ministry, and certainly his 400 or so regular customers hear plenty of preaching. Each spring he sends out a long, feisty, single-spaced letter that could convince even a fast food junkie that buying a pastured broiler from Polyface Farm qualifies as an act of social, environmental, nutritional, and political redemption. "Greetings from the non-barcode people," began one recent missive, before it launched into a high-flying jeremiad against our disconnected, multinational, global, corporate, techno-glitzy food system, with its industrial fecal factory concentration camp farms. The dangerous pile-up of modifiers is a hallmark of Joel's rhetorical style. He darkly warns that the government and their big food system fraternity mates are exploiting worries about bioterrorism to regulate small food producers out of business, and beseeches his customers to stand with Polyface during these paranoid, hysterical days. Like any good jeremiad, this one eventually transits from despair to hope, noting that the yearning in the human soul to smell a flower, pet a pig, and enjoy food with a face has never been stronger, before moving into a matter-of-fact discussion of this year's prices and the paramount importance of sending in your order blanks and showing up to collect your chickens on time. I'd met several of Polyface's 400 parishioners on Wednesday afternoon, and then again on Friday, as they came to collect the fresh chickens they'd reserved. It was a remarkably diverse group of people. A schoolteacher, several retirees, a young mom with her tow-headed twins, a mechanic, an opera singer, a furniture maker, a woman who worked in a metal fabrication plant in Staunton. They were paying a premium over supermarket prices for Polyface food, and in many cases driving more than an hour over a daunting, though gorgeous, tangle of county roads to come get it. But no one would ever mistake these people for the well-heeled urban foodies generally thought to be the market for organic or artisanal food. There was plenty of polyester in this crowd and a lot more Chevrolets than Volvos in the parking lot. So what exactly had they come all the way out here to the farm to buy? Here are some of the comments I jotted down. "This is the chicken I remember from my childhood. It actually tastes like chicken. I just don't trust the meat in the supermarket anymore. These eggs just jump up and slap you in the face. You're not going to find fresher chickens anywhere. All this meat comes from happy animals. I know because I've seen them. I drive 150 miles one way in order to get clean meat for my family. It's very simple. I trust the Salatins more than I trust the Walmart. And I like the idea of keeping my money right here in town." I was hearing, in other words, the same stew of food fears and food pleasures and memories that has driven the growth of the organic food industry over the past 20 years. That, and the satisfaction many Polyface customers clearly take in spending a little time on a farm, porch chatting with the Salatins, and taking a beautiful drive in the country to get here. For some people, reconnecting with the source of their food is a powerful idea. For the farmer, these on-farm sales allow him to recapture the 92 cents of a consumer's food dollar that now typically winds up in the pockets of processors, middlemen, and retailers. Later that afternoon, Joel and I took a long drive to Manita, at the southern end of the Shenandoah Valley. He was eager for me to meet Bev Eggleston, whose one-man marketing company, Eco-Friendly Foods, is a second route along which Polyface food finds its way to eaters. Eggleston, a former herb and livestock farmer who discovered he had a greater gift for marketing food than producing it, sells Polyface meat and eggs from his booths at farmers' markets in the Washington, D.C. area. On the drive, Joel and I talk about the growing local food movement, the challenges it faces, and the whole sticky issue of price. I asked Joel how he answers the charge that because food like his is more expensive, it is inherently elitist. "I don't accept the premise. First off, those weren't any elitists you met on the farm this morning. We sell to all kinds of people. Second, whenever I hear people say clean food is expensive, I tell them it's actually the cheapest food you can buy. That always gets their attention. Then I explain that with our food, all of the costs are figured into the price. Society is not bearing the cost of water pollution, of antibiotic resistance, of foodborne illnesses, of crop subsidies, of subsidized oil and water, of all the hidden costs to the environment and the taxpayer that make cheap food seem cheap. No thinking person will tell you they don't care about all that. I tell them the choice is simple. You can buy honestly priced food or you can buy irresponsibly priced food. He reminded me that his meat would be considerably cheaper than it is if not for the government regulations and the resulting high cost of processing, at least a dollar cheaper per pound. If we could just level the playing field, take away the regulations, the subsidies, and factor in the health care and environmental cleanup costs of cheap food, we could compete on price with anyone. It's true that cheap industrial food is heavily subsidized in many ways, such that its price in the supermarket does not reflect its real cost. But until the rules that govern our food system change, organic or sustainable food is going to cost more at the register, more than some people can afford. Yet, for the great majority of us, the story is not quite so simple. As a society, we Americans spend only a fraction of our disposable income feeding ourselves, about a tenth, down from a fifth in the 1950s. Americans today spend less on food as a percentage of disposable income than any other industrialized nation, and probably less than any people in the history of the world. This suggests that there are many of us who could afford to spend more on food if we chose to. After all, it isn't only the elite who in recent years have found an extra $50 or $100 each month to spend on cell phones, now owned by more than half the U.S. population, children included, or television, which close to 90% of all U.S. households now pay for. Another formerly free good that more than half of us happily pay for today is water. So is the unwillingness to pay more for food really a matter of affordability or priority? As things stand, artisanal producers like Joel compete not on price but quality, which, oddly enough, is still a somewhat novel idea when it comes to food. When someone drives up to the farm in a BMW and asks me why our eggs cost more, well, first I try not to get mad. Frankly, any city person who doesn't think I deserve a white-collar salary as a farmer doesn't deserve my special food. Let them eat E. coli. But I don't say that. Instead, I take him outside and point at his car. Sir, you clearly understand quality and are willing to pay for it. Well, food is no different. You get what you pay for. Why is it that we exempt food, of all things, from that rule? Industrial agriculture, because it depends on standardization, has bombarded us with the message that all pork is pork, all chicken is chicken, eggs, eggs, even though we all know that can't really be true. But it's downright un-American to suggest that one egg might be nutritionally superior to another. Joel recited the slogan of his local supermarket chain, "We pile it high and sell it cheap." What other business would ever sell its products that way? When you think about it, it is odd that something as important to our health and general well-being as food is so often sold strictly on the basis of price. The value of relationship marketing is that it allows many kinds of information besides price to travel up and down the food chain. Stories as well as numbers, qualities as well as quantities, values rather than value. And as soon as that happens, people begin to make different kinds of buying decisions, motivated by criteria other than price. But instead of stories about how it was produced accompanying our food, we get barcodes, as inscrutable as the industrial food chain itself, and a fair symbol of its almost total opacity. Not that a barcode needs to be so obscure or reductive. Supermarkets in Denmark have experimented with adding a second barcode to packages of meat that, when scanned at a kiosk in the store, brings up on a monitor images of the farm where the meat was raised, as well as detailed information on the particular animal's genetics, feed, medications, slaughter date, etc. Most of the meat in our supermarkets simply couldn't withstand that degree of transparency. If the barcode on the typical package of pork chops summoned images of the CAFO it came from and information on the pig's diet and drug regimen, who could bring themselves to buy it? Our food system depends on consumers not knowing much about it beyond the price disclosed by the checkout scanner. Cheapness and ignorance are mutually reinforcing. And it's a short way from not knowing who's at the other end of your food chain to not caring. to the carelessness of both producers and consumers. Of course, the global economy couldn't very well function without this wall of ignorance and the indifference it breeds. This is why the rules of world trade explicitly prohibit products from telling even the simplest stories, dolphin safe, humanely slaughtered, etc., about how they were produced. For his part, Joel would just as soon build local economies in which barcodes are unnecessary rather than attempt to enhance them, to use technology or labeling schemes to make the industrial food chain we have more transparent. I realized with a bit of a jolt that his pastoral or agrarian outlook doesn't adequately deal with the fact that so many of us now live in big cities far removed from the places where our food is grown and from opportunities for relationship marketing. When I asked how a place like New York City fit into his vision of a local food economy, he startled me with his answer. Why do we have to have a New York City? What good is it? If there was a dark side to Joel's vision of the post-industrial food chain, I realized, it was the deep antipathy to cities that has so often shadowed rural populism in this country. Though when I pressed him, pointing out that New York City, den of pestilence and iniquity though it might be, was probably here to stay and would need to eat, he allowed that farmers' markets and CSAs, community-supported agriculture, schemes in which customers subscribe to a farm, paying a few $100 at the start of the growing season in exchange for a weekly box of produce through the summer, might be a good way for urbanites to connect with distant farmers. For my own part, this taut little exchange made me appreciate what a deep gulf of culture and experience separates me from Joel. And yet, at the same time, what a sturdy bridge caring about food can sometimes provide. Sometimes, but not always, for the antipathy of city and country still runs deep, and in both directions. I once encouraged a food writer from a big city newspaper to pay a visit to Polyface. The day she got back, she telephoned me, all in a lather about the alien beings she'd had to spend the day with in Swope. "You never warned me he had a Jesus fish on his front door." When Joel and I arrived at Bev's office that afternoon, we were greeted by an intense, wiry, blue-eyed fellow in his 40s wearing shorts and a Polyface baseball cap, and talking a mile a minute. Joel had explained on the way down that Bev was at the moment operating under excruciating financial pressure. He had mortgaged his family's farm to build a small meat processing plant. Bev's experience at the farmers' markets had convinced him of the growing demand for pastured meat, but supply was limited by the shortage of small processing plants willing to work with the state's grass farmers. So he'd decided to build one himself. Bev was nearing the end of his financial rope while the USDA dilly-dallied on the approvals he needed to open. Yet when he'd finally secured the necessary permits, hired a crew, and begun killing animals, the USDA abruptly pulled its inspector, effectively shutting him down. They explained that Bev wasn't processing enough animals fast enough to justify the inspector's time. In other words, he wasn't sufficiently industrial, which of course was precisely the point of the whole venture. I realized Joel had wanted me to see Bev's predicament as proof of his contention that the government is putting obstacles in the path of an alternative food system. Remarkably under the circumstances, Bev, whose business card gives his full name as Beverly P. Eggleston IV, had not lost his sense of humor or weakness for bad puns and high-velocity patter. When I told him what I'd been up to on the farm all week, he cautioned me that trying to follow Joel around will give you carpool tunnels and old-timers' disease. Joel thinks Bev is the funniest man alive. He also fervently wants him to succeed and has been advancing him thousands of dollars worth of Polyface product to help float him while he does battle with the bureaucrats. After Bev took us on a tour through the shiny new processing facility, $1 million worth of stainless steel and white tile built to exacting USDA specifications and sitting idle, we repaired to the trailer home parked out back, where Bev appeared to be living on potato chips and caffeinated soda. Every weekend he drives the 300 miles up to Washington with a truckload of product from Joel and other grass farmers from all over Virginia. I asked him about selling pastured meats at farmers' markets, about exactly what it took to get people to pay the extra money. What I sell them on is where they're coming from, Bev explained. There's a whole wheel of reasons to work with, and you've got 3 seconds to figure out what their issue is. Animal cruelty? Pesticides? Nutrition? Taste? Joel had told me Bev is a born salesman. He could sell a hat rack to a moose. And it wasn't hard to imagine him working the Saturday crowd, hitting the adjacent chords of fear and pleasure and health, all the while barbecuing free samples and unspooling his high-speed shtick. This is food for folks whose faces itch when the wool's being pulled over their eyes, Bev said, giving me a taste of his spiel. Instead of mad cow disease, we've got glad cows at ease. Not many farmers can do this. Indeed, many farmers become farmers precisely so they don't have to do any such thing. They'd much prefer to work with animals or plants rather than human strangers. And for these farmers, direct relationship marketing isn't an option, which is why they're happy to have someone like Bev work the farmers' markets for them, even if that means giving him a cut on top of the 6% the farmers' market already takes from every dollar of sales. It's still a vastly better deal than wholesaling commodities. Sitting around the trailer's tiny kitchen table drinking sodas, Bev and Joel talked about the economics of selling food locally. Joel said the farmer's market was his least profitable outlet, which is why he had stopped doing them himself a few years ago. All the same, farmer's markets have blossomed in recent years, their number increasing from 1,755 a decade ago to 3,137 at last count. Joel was even higher on metropolitan buying clubs, a scheme with which I was not familiar. A group of families gets together to place a big order once or twice a month. A lead person organizes everything and offers her home as a pickup site, usually in exchange for free product. The size of the order makes it worth the farmer's while to deliver, in Joel's case, sometimes as far as Virginia Beach or Bethesda, half a day's drive. Metropolitan buying clubs represent the fastest growing segment of Joel's market. Who were these consumers? In Joel's case, mostly young mothers concerned about the health of their children, many of them drawn from the homeschooling community, people who have already opted out once, or from an organization called the Weston Price Foundation. Dr. Weston Price was a dentist who in the 1930s began to wonder why isolated, primitive tribes had so much better teeth and general good health than people living in industrialized countries. He traveled all over the world researching the diets of the healthiest, longest-lived populations and found certain common denominators in their diets. They ate lots of meat and fats from wild or pastured animals, unpasteurized dairy products, unprocessed whole grains, and foods preserved by fermentation. Today, the foundation, which is run by a nutritionist and cookbook author named Sally Fallon, promotes these traditional diets in books and conferences, as well as on its website, where Joel is one of the producers often cited. The beauty of the Internet is that it allows like-minded people to find their tribes, and then for the tribes to find their way to us, all without the expense of marketing or a storefront. EatWild.com, a site that promotes the benefits of pastured meat and dairy, is another route by which consumers find their way to Polyface. It's never been easier for people to opt out. Opting out is a key term for Joel, who believes that it would be a fatal mistake to try to sell a connected, holistic, ensouled product through a Western, reductionist Wall Street sales scheme. By which, I think, he means selling to Whole Foods. As far as both Joel and Bev are concerned, there isn't a world of difference between Whole Foods and Walmart. Both are part of an increasingly globalized economy that turns anything it touches into a commodity, reaching its tentacles wherever in the world a food can be produced most cheaply, and then transporting it wherever it can be sold most dearly. Late in our conversation, Joel asked Bev and me if we'd seen a recent column by Alan Nation in Stockman Grass Farmer about artisanal economics. Drawing on the theories of Harvard Business School professor Michael Porter, Nation had distinguished between industrial and artisanal enterprises to demonstrate why attempts to blend the two modes seldom succeed. Industrial farmers are in the business of selling commodities, he explained, a business where the only viable competitive strategy is to be the least cost producer. The classic way any industrial producer lowers the costs of his product is by substituting capital, new technologies and fossil fuel energy, for skilled labor, and then stepping up production, exploiting the economies of scale to compensate for shrinking profit margins. In a commodity business, a producer must sell ever more cheaply and grow ever bigger or be crushed by a competitor who does. Nation contrasted this industrial model with its polar opposite, what he calls artisanal production, where the competitive strategy is based on selling something special rather than being the least cost producer of a commodity. Stressing that productivity and profits are two entirely different concepts, Nation suggests that even a small producer can be profitable so long as he's selling an exceptional product and keeping his expenses down. Yet this artisanal model works only so long as it doesn't attempt to imitate the industrial model in any respect. It must not try to replace skilled labor with capital. It must not grow for the sake of growth. It should not strive for uniformity in its products, but rather make a virtue of variation and seasonality. It shouldn't invest capital to reach national markets, but rather should focus on local markets, relying on reputation and word of mouth rather than on advertising. And lastly, it should rely as much as possible on free solar energy rather than costly fossil fuels. The biggest problem with alternative agriculture today, Nation writes, is that it seeks to incorporate bits and pieces of the industrial model and bits and pieces of the artisanal model. This will not work. In the middle of the road, you get the worst of both worlds. Nation's column had helped Joel understand why his broiler business was more profitable than his beef or pork business. Since he could process the chickens himself, the product was artisanal from start to finish. His beef and pork, on the other hand, had to pass through an industrial processing plant, adding to his costs and shrinking his margins. No one needed to spell it out, but the Porter Nation theory also helped explain Bev's current predicament. He had built an artisanal meat plant, designed to custom process pastured livestock humanely and scrupulously, no more than a few dozen animals a day. But his artisanal enterprise was being forced to conform to a USDA regulatory system that is based on an industrial model. Indeed, that was created in response to the industrial abuses Upton Sinclair chronicled in The Jungle. The federal regulatory regime is expressly designed for a large slaughterhouse operated by unskilled and indifferent workers, killing and cutting as many as 400 feedlot animals an hour. The volume of such an operation can easily cover the costs of things like a dedicated restroom for the inspector, or elaborate machinery to steam clean or irradiate carcasses presumed to carry E. coli. The specifications and costly technologies implicitly assume that the animals being processed have been living in filth and eating corn rather than grass. The industrial packing plant where number 534 met his end can take a steer from knocker to boxed beef for about $50 a head. It would cost nearly 10 times as much to process him in a custom facility like this. The industrial and artisanal economies clash right here in Bev's packing plant, and, sadly, it's not hard to guess which one will ultimately prevail. Thursday morning. I woke to the sound of Joel's brother Art's panel truck noisily backing up to the salesroom door. The clock said 5:45 a.m. Thursday is delivery day, and Art likes to start staging orders and organizing his truck before any of the other farmers he makes deliveries for shows up. I threw on some clothes and dashed out to meet him. Art is 5 years older than Joel and, on first impression, a very different sort of character. Not nearly so sunny or expansive, more grounded in the world as it is and, perhaps as a result, prone to flashes of crankiness I've never observed in Joel. But then Art works in a less pastoral world, one in which he has to contend with city traffic and overzealous meter maids as well as the occasional temperamental chef. Compared to his brother's revolutionary zeal, Art seems to have passed the point of believing that this world, or for that matter, the human soul, is ever going to be substantially different than we find it. Every Thursday, Art mounts a scrupulously planned military operation to supply Charlottesville's white tablecloth restaurants with pastured meat and eggs from Polyface, as well as produce, dairy products, and mushrooms from a half dozen other small producers in the Shenandoah Valley. He phones his farmers on Monday night to find out what they've got, faxes his chefs an order list Tuesday morning, sells and writes orders all day Tuesday, Tuesday night faxes them to the farmers so they can harvest Wednesday, and then reconnoiter with Art in the Polyface parking lot shortly after dawn on Thursday. I spent the better part of Thursday riding shotgun in Art's panel truck, an old orange Dodge Caravan with a cranky compressor on the roof and a sign on the side that says, "On delivery from Polyface Incorporated. Follow me to the best restaurants in town." Which seemed to be more or less the case. Most of Charlottesville's best chefs buy from Polyface, primarily chicken and eggs, but also lots of pork and as many rabbits as Daniel can raise. We made most of our deliveries after lunch, when the kitchens were prepping dinner and relatively quiet. After Art nailed down a quasi-legal parking spot, I'd help him haul in plastic totes the size of laundry baskets laden with meat and produce. The chefs had uniformly high praise for the quality of Polyface produce and clearly felt good about supporting a local farm, which many of them had visited on one of the chef appreciation days that Polyface holds each summer. I could have filled a notebook with their encomiums. A few? Okay. A happier chicken. Great. But frankly, for me, it's all about the taste, which is just so different. This is a chickenier chicken. Art's chickens just taste cleaner, like the chicken I remember when I was a kid. I try to buy from people who were in my community and stand by their food. Don Tyson, on the other hand, stands behind a bunch of lawyers. Oh, those beautiful eggs. The difference is night and day. The color and richness and fat content. There's just no comparison. I always have to adjust my recipes for these eggs. You never need as many as they call for. Between stops, Art mentioned that Joel's eggs usually gave him his foot in the door when trying to land a new account. We stopped in at one such prospect, a newly opened restaurant called The Filling Station. Art introduced himself and presented the chef with a brochure and a dozen eggs. The chef cracked one into a saucepan. Instead of spreading out flabbily, the eggs stood up nice and tall in the pan. Joel refers to this as muscle tone. When he first began selling eggs to chefs, he'd crack one right into the palm of his hand and then flip the yolk back and forth from one hand to another to demonstrate its integrity. The filling station chef called his staff over to admire the vibrant orange color of the yolk. Art explained that it was the grass diet that gave the eggs their color, indicating lots of beta-carotene. I don't think I'd ever seen an egg yolk rivet so many people for so long. Art beamed. He was in. At one restaurant, the chef inquired if Art could find him some game birds. Maybe in the fall, Art offered. Later, back in the truck, Art launched into a little diatribe about seasonality, one of the stiffest challenges facing the development of a local food economy. We have to battle the idea that you can have anything you want any time you want it. Like spring lamb. What the hell does that mean? That's not its natural cycle. You want lambs to hit the ground when the grass is lush in April. They won't be ready for 8 to 10 months after that, not till early winter. But the markets become totally out of sync with nature. We should eat red meat when it's cold, but people want chicken in the winter when we don't have it. A global food market, which brings us New Zealand lamb in the spring, Chilean asparagus in December, and fresh tomatoes the year round, has smudged the bright colors of the seasonal food calendar we all once knew by heart. Which brings us New Zealand lamb in the spring, Chilean asparagus in December, and fresh tomatoes the year round, has smudged the bright colors of the seasonal food calendar we all once knew by heart. But for local food chains to succeed, people will have to relearn what it means to eat according to the seasons. This is especially true in the case of pastured animals, which can be harvested only after they've had several months on rapidly growing grass. Feeding animals corn in CAFOs has accustomed us to a year-round supply of fresh meats, many of which we forget were once eaten as seasonally as tomatoes or sweet corn. People would eat most of their beef and pork in late fall or winter, when the animals were fat, and eat chicken in the summer. Joel told me that when he first began selling eggs to chefs, he found himself apologizing for their pallid hue in winter. The yolks would lose their rich orange color when the chickens came in off the pasture in November. Then he met a chef who told him not to worry about it. The chef explained that in cooking school in Switzerland, he'd been taught recipes that specifically called for April eggs, August eggs, and December eggs. Some seasons produce better yolks, others better whites, and chefs would adjust their menus accordingly. Both Joel and Art evinced the deepest respect for their chefs, who not only seldom argued price and wrote checks right on the spot, but clearly appreciated their work and, very often, acknowledged it right on their menus. Polyface Farm Chicken is something I saw on menus and specials boards all over Charlottesville. This informal alliance of small farmers and local chefs is something you find in many cities these days. Indeed, ever since Alice Waters opened Chez Panisse in Berkeley in 1973, chefs have been instrumental in helping rebuild local food economies all over America. Waters made a point of sourcing much of her food from local organic growers, cooked only what was in season, and shone the bright light of glamour on the farmers, turning many of them into menu celebrities. Chefs like Waters have also done much to educate the public about the virtues of local agriculture, the pleasures of eating by the season, and the superior qualities of exceptionally fresh food grown with care and without chemicals. The Roman writer Livy once warned that when a society's chefs come to be regarded as consequential figures, it is a sure sign that society is well down the road to decadence. Livy's rule might have held up until the 1960s in America, but clearly no longer. Who would ever have guessed before then that America's chefs would be leading a movement to save small farmers and reform America's food system? To talk to the chefs, customers, and farmers working together in this one corner of the country to rebuild the local food chain is to appreciate that it is a movement and not merely a market. Or rather, it is a novel hybrid. A market as movement, for at its heart is a new conception of what it means to be a consumer, an attempt to redeem that ugly word, with its dismal colorings of selfishness and subtraction. Many of the Polyface customers I met, though by no means all of them, had come to see their decision to buy a chicken from a local farmer rather than from Walmart as a kind of civic act, even a form of protest. A protest of what, exactly, is harder to pin down, and each person might put it a little differently. But the customers I met at Polyface had gone to some trouble and expense to opt out of the supermarket, of the fast food nation, and standing behind that, of a globalized industrial agriculture. Their talk of distrusting Walmart, resenting the abuse of animals in farm factories, insisting on knowing who was growing their food, and wanting to keep their food dollars in town, all this suggested that for many of these people, spending a little more for a dozen eggs was a decision inflected by a politics, however tentative or inchoate. End of Disc 8. Shortly before I traveled to Virginia, I'd read an essay by Wendell Berry called The Whole Horse, in which he argued that reversing the damage done to local economies and the land by the juggernaut of world trade would take nothing less than a revolt of local small producers and local consumers against the global industrialism of the corporation. He detected the stirrings of such a rebellion in the rise of local food systems and the growing market for good, fresh, trustworthy food, food from producers known and trusted by consumers. Berry would have us believe that what I was seeing in the Polyface sales room represented a local uprising in a gathering worldwide rebellion against what he calls the total economy. Why should food, of all things, be the linchpin of that rebellion? Perhaps because food is a powerful metaphor for a great many of the values to which people feel globalization poses a threat, including the distinctiveness of local cultures and identities, the survival of local landscapes, and biodiversity. When José Bové, the French anti-globalization activist and Roquefort farmer, wanted to make his stand against globalization, He drove his tractor through the plate glass not of a bank or insurance company, but of a McDonald's. Indeed, the most powerful protests against globalization to date have all revolved around food. I'm thinking of the movement against genetically modified crops, the campaign against patented seeds in India, which a few years ago brought 400,000 Indians into the street to protest WTO intellectual property rules, and Slow Food, the Italian-born international movement that seeks to defend traditional food cultures against the global tide of homogenization. Even for people who find the logic of globalization otherwise compelling, the globalization of food often stops them short. That logic treats food as a commodity like any other, and that simply doesn't square with people's beliefs or experience. Once the last barrier to free trade comes down, and the last program of government support for farmers ends, our food will come from wherever in the world it can be produced most cheaply. The iron law of competitive advantage dictates that if another country can grow something more efficiently, whether because its land or labor is cheaper or its environmental laws more lax, we will no longer grow it here. What's more, under the global economic dispensation, this is an outcome to be wished for, since it will free our land for more productive uses. More houses, say. Since land in the United States is relatively expensive and our tolerance for agricultural pollution and animal cruelty is wearing thin, in the future, all our food may come from elsewhere. This argument has been made by, among others, economist Stephen Blank in a book rather bloodlessly titled The End of Agriculture in the American Portfolio. And why should a nation produce its own food when others can produce it more cheaply? A dozen reasons leap to mind, but most of them the Stephen Blanks of the world, and they are legion, are quick to dismiss as sentimental. I'm thinking of the sense of security that comes from knowing that your community or country can feed itself. The beauty of an agricultural landscape. The outlook and kinds of local knowledge that farmers bring to a community. The satisfactions of buying food from a farmer you know rather than the supermarket. The locally inflected flavor of a raw milk cheese or honey. All those things, all those pastoral values, globalization proposes to sacrifice in the name of efficiency and economic growth. Though you do begin to wonder who is truly the realist in this debate and who the romantic. We live, as Barry has written in an essay called The Total Economy, in an era of sentimental economics, since the promise of global capitalism, much like the promise of communism before it, ultimately demands an act of faith. That if we permit the destruction of certain things we value here and now, we will achieve a greater happiness and prosperity at some unspecified future time. As Lenin put it, in a sentiment the WTO endorses in its rulings every day, you have to break a few eggs to make an omelet. Perhaps it is no accident that sentimental communism foundered precisely on the issue of food. The Soviets sacrificed millions of small farms and farmers to the dream of a collectivized industrial agriculture that never managed to do what a food system has to do, feed the nation. By the time of its collapse, more than half of the food consumed in the Soviet Union was being produced by small farmers and home gardeners operating without official sanction, on private plots tucked away in the overlooked corners and cracks of the crumbling Soviet monolith. George Naylor, speaking from deep inside the American monolith, might be on to something when, during our conversations about industrial agriculture, he likened the rise of alternative food chains in America to the last days of Soviet agriculture. The centralized food system wasn't serving the people's needs, so they went around it. The rise of farmers' markets and CSAs is sending the same signal today. Of course, the problems of our food system are very different. If anything, it produces too much food, not too little, or too much of the wrong food. But there's no question that it is failing many consumers and producers, which is why they are finding creative ways around it. So much about life in a global economy feels as though it has passed beyond the individual's control. What happens to our jobs, to the prices at the gas station, to the vote in the legislature? But somehow food still feels a little different. We can still decide every day what we're going to put into our bodies, what sort of food chain we want to participate in. We can, in other words, reject the industrial omelet on offer and decide to eat another. This might not sound like a big deal, but it could be the beginnings of one. Already the desire on the part of consumers to put something different into their bodies has created an $11 billion market in organic food. That marketplace was built by consumers and farmers working informally together outside the system, with exactly no help from the government. Today, the total economy, astounding in its ability to absorb every challenge, is well on its way to transforming organic from a reform movement into an industry, another flavor in the global supermarket. It took capitalism less than a quarter century to turn even something as ephemeral as bagged salads of cut and washed organic mesclun, of all things, into a cheap international commodity retailed in a new organic supermarket. Whether this is a good or bad thing, people will disagree. Joel Salatin and his customers want to be somewhere that juggernaut can't go. And it may be that by elevating local above organic, they have found exactly that place. By definition, local is a hard thing to sell in a global marketplace. Local food, as opposed to organic, implies a new economy as well as a new agriculture, new social and economic relationships as well as new ecological ones. It's a lot more complicated. Of course, just because food is local doesn't necessarily mean it will be organic or even sustainable. There's nothing to stop a local farmer from using chemicals or abusing animals, except the gaze or good word of his customers. Instead of looking at labels, the local food customer will look at the farm for himself, or look the farmer in the eye and ask him about how he grows his crops or treats his animals. That said, there are good reasons to think a genuinely local agriculture will tend to be a more sustainable agriculture. For one thing, it is much less likely to rely on monoculture, the original sin from which almost every other problem of our food system flows. A farmer dependent on a local market will, perforce, need to grow a wide variety of things rather than specialize in the one or two plants or animals that the national market, organic or otherwise, would ask from him. The supermarket wants all its lettuce from the Salinas Valley, all of its apples from Washington State, and all its corn from Iowa. At least until the day it decides it wants all its corn from Argentina, all of its apples from China, and all of its lettuce from Mexico. People in Iowa can eat only so much corn and soybeans themselves. So when Iowans decide to eat locally, rather than from the supermarket, their farmers will quickly learn to grow a few other things besides. And when they do, they'll probably find that they can give up most of their fertilizers and pesticides, since a diversified farm will produce much of its own fertility and its own pest control. Shopping in the organic supermarket underwrites important values on the farm. Shopping locally underwrites a whole set of other values as well. That's because farms produce a lot more than food. They also produce a kind of landscape and a kind of community. Whether Polyface's customers spend their food dollars here in Swope or in the Whole Foods in Charlottesville will have a large bearing on whether this lovely valley, this undulating checkerboard of fields and forests, will endure, or whether the total economy will find a higher use for it. "Eat your view" is a bumper sticker often seen in Europe these days. As it implies, the decision to eat locally is an act of conservation, too, one that is probably more effective and sustainable than writing checks to environmental organizations. Eat your view takes work, however. To participate in a local food economy requires considerably more effort than shopping at the Whole Foods. You won't find anything microwavable at the farmer's market or in your CSA box, and you won't find a tomato in December. The local food shopper will need to put some work into sourcing his food, into learning who grows the best lamb in his area or the best sweet corn. And then he will have to become reacquainted with his kitchen. Much of the appeal of the industrial food chain is its convenience. It offers busy people a way to delegate their cooking and food preservation to others. At the other end of the industrial food chain that begins in a cornfield in Iowa sits an industrial eater at a table, or, increasingly, in a car. The achievement of the industrial food system over the past half century has been to transform most of us into precisely that creature. All of which is to say that a successful local food economy implies not only a new kind of food producer, but a new kind of eater as well, one who regards finding, preparing, and preserving food as one of the pleasures of life rather than a chore. One whose sense of taste has ruined him for a Big Mac, and whose sense of place has ruined him for shopping for groceries at Walmart. This is the consumer who understands, or remembers, that in Wendell Berry's memorable phrase, eating is an agricultural act. He might have added that it's a political act as well. This is precisely the mission that Slow Food has set for itself: to remind a generation of industrial eaters of their connections to farmers and farms, and to the plants and animals we depend on. The movement, which began in 1989 as a protest against the opening of a McDonald's in Rome, recognizes that the best way to fight industrial eating is by simply recalling people to the infinitely superior pleasures of traditional foods enjoyed communally. The consumer becomes, in founder Carlo Petrini's phrase, a co-producer. His eating contributes to the survival of landscapes and species and traditional foods that would otherwise succumb to the fast food ideal of one world, one taste. Even connoisseurship can have a politics, Slow Food wagers, since an eater in closer touch with his senses will find less pleasure in a box of chicken McNuggets than in a pastured chicken or a rare breed of pig. It's all very Italian, and decidedly un-American, to insist that doing the right thing is the most pleasurable thing, and that the act of consumption might be an act of addition rather than subtraction. On my last day on the farm, a soft June Friday afternoon, Joel and I sat talking at a picnic table behind the house while a steady stream of customers dropped by to pick up their chickens. I asked him if he believed the industrial food chain would ever be overturned by an informal, improvised movement made up of farmers' markets, box schemes, metropolitan buying clubs, slow foodies, and artisanal meat processing plants like Bev Eggleston's. Even if you count the organic supermarket, the entire market for all alternative foods remains but a flea on the colossus of the industrial food economy, with its numberless fast food outlets and supermarkets backed by infinite horizons of corn and soybeans. "We don't have to beat them," Joel patiently explained. "I'm not even sure we should try. We don't need a law against McDonald's or a law against slaughterhouse abuse. We ask for too much salvation by legislation. All we need to do is empower individuals with the right philosophy and the right information to opt out en masse. And make no mistake, it's happening. The mainstream is splitting into smaller and smaller groups of like-minded people. It's a little like Luther nailing his 99 Theses up at Gutenberg. Back then, it was the printing press that allowed the Protestants to break off and form their own communities. Now it's the internet, splintering us into tribes that want to go their own way." Of course. Joel saw himself as more of a Luther than a Lenin. The goal wasn't to blow up the church, but simply to step around it. Protestantism also comes in many denominations, as I suspect will the future of food. Deciding whether that future should more closely resemble Joel's radically local vision or Whole Foods' industrial organic matters less than assuring that thriving alternatives exist. Feeding the cities may require a different sort of food chain than feeding the countryside. We may need a great many different alternative food chains, organic and local, biodynamic and slow, and others yet undreamed of. As in the fields, nature provides the best model for the marketplace, and nature never puts all her eggs in one basket. The great virtue of a diversified food economy, like a diverse pasture or farm, is its ability to withstand any shock. The important thing is that there be multiple food chains, so that when any one of them fails, when the oil runs out, when mad cow or other food-borne diseases become epidemic, when the pesticides no longer work, when drought strikes and plagues come and soils blow away, we'll still have a way to feed ourselves. It is because some of those failures are already in view that the sales room at Polyface Farm is buzzing with activity this afternoon, and why farmers' markets in towns and cities all across America are buzzing this afternoon, too. An alternative food system is rising up on the margins, Joel continued. One day, Frank Perdue and Don Tyson are going to wake up and find that their world has changed. It won't happen overnight, but it will happen, just as it did for those Catholic priests who came to church one Sunday morning